surprise if there are only three people out here. My name is Jonathan Cohen, as you can see, and I've been asked, along with Mary Wong, my partner in crime, to moderate this panel to take a quick look at the current state of the UDRP as set out after a brief preliminaries issues report and a webinar which involved most of the people you see on the panel. Now, I think it's important to remember this was a preliminary issues report. Nothing's going to get decided here. Nobody's voting on anything. There'll be lots of time for the usual comment and debate in any process in ICANN, and there will ultimately be a final issues report before the matter goes back to the GNSO Council for a decision. So this is just a chance for those who haven't been following to get some idea of what's going on. Just very briefly, in February last, the Council did ask for a preliminaries issue report, which was given by the staff with various thoughts and not conclusions, but senses of what it felt the community was saying based on the webinar. Really, it came down to a series of different positions, which are more or less, there seemed to be a significant number who felt that probably no PDP was a good idea at this particular time, but there were clearly people who felt that after 10 years, there was a real need for a review, and there are others in other communities who feel it's really urgent to have a free speech defense enshrined in the UDRP. And more people, and quite a few, felt that there are a number of process issues as opposed to policy issues which should or could be addressed now without a full PDP. And I don't think I need to say any more about this at this time. So, Mary?
Well, Jonathan, I think you covered all the bases, but I just would like to emphasize that, as Jonathan has mentioned, we are at the stage of a preliminary issue report, and for those folks who have been around ICANN land for a while, that might be a somewhat odd concept because the Council has considered and is considering adopting a working framework for policy development processes, or PDPs, where there would first be a preliminary issue report with an attached public comment period. And with respect to this issue, the public comment period is already open and will stay open. So the idea is that as between the preliminary issue report and the final report, which will be prepared at the close of that period, that community feedback is really important. So to that end, the webinar that Jonathan mentioned, as well as today's session, combined the public comments, is really critical to getting the full information before the Council. And the other point I wanted to mention is that we do have a very distinguished panel today. As Jonathan said, some of them were also speakers at the earlier webinar that some of you may have participated in. It was also very important to try to get as broad a diversity of representations and perspectives as possible, and that's what we're hoping to accomplish today as well. I think what we're going to do is we'll try to kick off the discussion by first having Margie, who has been shepherding the report and the process, give a brief update on where we are in the sense of what the issue report pretty much said, and then open the floor to the panelists for discussion. Margie?
Thank you, Mary. I've prepared some slides. I'm not going to go into a lot of detail on them because I think it's important to have discussion. But just to give you background on what's going on, as you can see, there's been a lot of work that led to the publication of the preliminary issue report. We did have this webinar on May 10th where we invited experts from across the spectrum of people that have dealt with the UDRP to really hear their opinions. And we also sent to each of the UDRP providers a questionnaire to get information that could be reflected in the issue report. So I'll provide you a link in one of these slides to the issue report. I invite you to take a look at it and to provide your comment. The public comment period is open until July 15th, and this is going to lead to a vote in the GNSO Council as to whether or not to initiate a policy development process on the UDRP. And so the crux of the issue report was what is the current state of the UDRP? And from the staff perspective, we really feel that the UDRP, having been in effect for over 10 years, is a successful policy. We look at the 30,000 complaints that have been filed over the decade. See that there are four service providers that are servicing the community and really providing choice and competition in service and in dealing with these disputes. If you think about what the world was like before the UDRP, if there was a dispute related to trademark infringement, you would have to go to court, and sometimes that would be very costly, involving parties from different jurisdictions. And so the benefit of the UDRP is to provide a viable alternative to that costly litigation. And the success of the UDRP is reflected in the fact that it has served as a model for CCTLDs and really adopted in various registries, reflecting the importance of it and the fact that it does provide an alternative to litigation. The other thing that is useful is that the service providers have dedicated a lot of resources in really educating the community on the UDRP and publishing decisions. And so there's a lot of information out there that helps respondents and complainants understand their rights and the and how to take advantage of the policy itself. And so in the report, we talk about the various opinions that were reflected in the webinar that we indicated earlier. And the thing that struck us as staff was that across the board, there seems to be a reflection that the UDRP is effective and fair to respondents. One of the things that various speakers noted was that it's flexible, and the theories that deal with trademark infringement have evolved over time, and the UDRP has been flexible enough to evolve over time. So as an example, one of the speakers indicated that, there's theories such as, how to deal with domain tasting, how to deal with reverse domain name hijacking. These are all complex issues that relate to trademark infringement, yet the panelists and the providers have dealt with it, and the decisions have accommodated the various thinking with respect to these issues. The other thing that was noted was that the UDRP is viewed as predictable, and that's a good thing, and transparent. So if you're a complainant or you're a respondent, you can look at the decisions that are out there and really understand, where you stand and what the likelihood is of actually prevailing in a dispute. There were some that noted that the UDRP is unfair to brand holders, but that's primarily because of the volume of disputes that you have to go through because of the increased incidence of cyber squatting. So it's not so much that the policy itself is unfair, but that the volume of it, when there's a vast amount of cyber squatting, is quite expensive to brand holders. And the theme that I think you'll pick up as you read the issue report is that although everyone recognizes that the UDRP is not perfect, there was this consensus, if you will. I mean, it's not a GNSO consensus, but it was a sentiment that more harm than good can be done if a policy development process is initiated at this time. And so what we heard in the webinar from the various viewpoints was that if there is to be a review of the UDRP, it might be best to focus on process improvements. And that generally, from the various stakeholders that participated in this webinar, there was this viewpoint that a PDP could actually undermine the effectiveness of the UDRP. And so that's the reason several folks thought that it was not a good idea to initiate a policy development process at this time. So as part of a preliminary issue report, there is a section of it that deals with the staff recommendation. And when we looked at these perspectives that we heard from the webinar, we felt that given the community view that the UDRP should not be tampered with, that we recommend against initiating a policy development process at this time. We feel, though, that if the council believes that something should be done with the UDRP, that we're suggesting an alternative approach. And that approach could be to convene a team of experts that would focus specifically on process recommendations and to come back with ways to improve the process itself as opposed to looking at the policy. And once that expert team comes up with its recommendations and those are hopefully adopted and implemented, you know, the council could always initiate a policy development process at a later time if you want to deal with specifics related to the policy itself. And I have a couple slides that talk about the issues that were raised in the webinar. I'm not going to go into detail on them because it would take quite a bit of time, but I invite you to look at the preliminary issue report because they're spelled out in the issue report. And what we tried to do in the issue report was to divide up these various issues that were raised related to the UDRP into two categories. The first one being the policy issues, things that probably would require a policy development process if we were to look at these issues, and then others that are process-related that perhaps a policy development process or a PDP may not be necessary at this time. And so as I inventoried these issues, these were the issues that we felt that were policy issues, such as the bad faith requirement. In the UDRP, there's a notion that you have to prove that there's bad faith registration and use in order to prevail. And so there's a discussion regarding whether the word "and" should be replaced with "or" so that you don't have to show registration and use. As it currently exists. And if that change were to be made, that's more like a policy discussion as opposed to a process issue. The other issue, issues that relate to policy are the fact that the policy itself doesn't have safe harbors, and there's a suggestion that the policy should reference free speech and fair use. In the actual, you know, implementation of the UDRP, the panelists look at those issues, but it's not, you know, expressly written into the policy itself, and so that's another area that might be explored. And then the third one is the appeals. There's no express appeals in the policy itself, so in the policy you can't appeal a decision you don't like. But you can go to court. You can, you know, always appeal through the courts in your national jurisdiction. And so, finally, these next slides really lay out the kinds of issues that were raised that relate to process. And again, these are very extensive. There's probably 10 slides here, and in the interest of time, I'm not going to go through them. But as you see them, and the materials are posted on the information for the session, you can see that they're quite extensive. And if a policy development process were initiated to deal with these, it would be quite complex and would take a bit of time to get through some of these issues. Because these are complex legal theories and issues that would need a lot of time and attention if we were to explore them through a policy development process. And so, you know, there's things related to timing, the language of proceedings, forum shopping. There's concerns about how you deal with responses and defaults. And information regarding the parties, issues related to laches, which is a very technical legal concept, and evidence, how to deal with submission of evidence in the policy itself. And again, if a policy development process is initiated, these are the kinds of things that would probably be looked at if the GNSO Council were to approve a policy development process. And again, I'm not going to go through them because they are extensive, but feel free to browse through the materials that are posted on the information for the session. So, sorry, let's see if I can get to the end here. Yeah, there's quite a bit. And then finally, here's the information where you can really participate. If you want to hear the webinar that took place, we have an archive posted on the ICANN website. The link is provided on this slide. And then again, I encourage you to participate in the public comment forum, which is open until July 15th. And with that, I hand it over back to the moderators.
Thanks, Margie. Jonathan, I just wanted to jump in here and just let folks know if you're online and looking at the agenda for today, if you're in the details for the session today, you click on the link that takes you to the community wiki page where the bios of all our panelists, as well as a link to the actual issue report, can be found. And that if you're not that familiar with the issue report or if you've read it, but you know, the 52 Annex 2 recommendations are not emblazoned in your memory, it might be helpful. Jonathan?
Thanks, Mary. Thank you, Margie. I thought we've talked about this. We think the best way to do this is, of course, for Mary and I to say as little as possible, try and kind of direct questions and suggestions to the panelists, who, after all, you're here to listen to. We've talked about the order in which people should speak, and we've come up with one where we think it will balance the different perspectives and points of view, one after the other, as you hear from them, and I think may lead to a more lively discussion. Now, one of the things that we're hoping, and I'm asking the panelists to listen to this, is that there's obviously a difference between being asked if there's a PDP, you know, what do you want changed or looked at, and whether you want or feel there's an urgent need for PDP. And I'd like each of the panelists to consider that question in their remarks. In addition, I would like them to consider the question of whether, even if they feel there is a reasonably urgent need for review, does it need to be a PDP? Or is there some other form of review that they think might be useful in the current circumstances, such as, for instance, a panel of experts, which has been mentioned, where you turn it over to experts who focus on specific problems and solutions to them rather than just a general focus. Possibly even hand it back to the to WIPO or a group of providers rather than WIPO to look at that. These are all possibilities. And last but not least, I'd like people to kind of at least take a passing swipe at the issue of policy versus process. There have been a lot of comments that make it clear that it isn't always as simple as one seems to divide these issues into policy and process, and perhaps more important, there are many who seem to feel that some process decisions ultimately impact policy, and therefore that's a question that I think we need to think about in answering these things. So, without the other questions I'd like to ask really specifically, do you think there is a need for, and there should be, a PDP now, before the new GTLDs have been operating with the new untested RPMs for 18 to 24 months, and why? Do you think a review of UDRP, if approved by the GNSO Council, should or could be done in a manner other than a PDP, along the lines I've earlier mentioned? And I'm doing this for information's sake, to put the panelists' thoughts out there and to get people in the audience and in the community thinking about these possibilities. And hopefully they'll comment. Okay, without further ado from me, the order of speaking I'm proposing will be Professor Konstantinos, followed by David Turner Roach with WIPO, followed with John Berryhill, then Mark Partridge of the ABA, then the Registrar Stakeholder Group Staten Hammock, rights holder Susan Kawaguchi from Facebook, the National Arbitration Forum, Christine Durain, and last but certainly not least, the Czech Arbitration Court, Petr Hostis. So I'm going to turn the mic over to Konstantinos.
Thank you, Jonathan, and good morning, everybody. For those of you who know me and know my background, I think that it should not come as a surprise that I am in favor of a review of the UDRP. And this is for many reasons. First of all, for the UDRP is the oldest ICANN policy, and it's been in place for more than 10 years. Thus, it is important for us to at least initiate discussions as to how we can make the system work better. Secondly, and most importantly, if you want, and in relation to what Jonathan was saying, because we use the language of the UDRP, and we will be using also the process of the UDRP in the newly formed URS, it is important that we do get the URS right. And I truly believe that the UDRP, we back in 1999, because we really did not know exactly what cyber squatting was and what abusive domain name registrations entail. The UDRP worked, but since then there are so many issues that have emerged, and the UDRP has manifested that there are some issues that it's not able to cope with. So contrary to what other panelists here might feel, I believe that the UDRP is not a truly fair system, and it certainly could, we could do something in order to make it more fair. Of course, for me, the big elephant in the room is, should we review the UDRP, which way it's, we're going to go? I mean, there are going to be various groups that they want to be able and see many things inserted within the UDRP, and that is pretty understandable. So there is a great fear as to whether we should touch the UDRP, whether it is the appropriate time to touch the UDRP. But what I would like to address to all of you is that this fear should not actually prevent us from going and looking at the UDRP, looking how we can make the UDRP better, looking how we can make the UDRP a more fair system, a system that is able to address the concerns of trademark owners as well as domain name registrants. And one of the most critical questions that we also have to resolve is whether there's going to be a substantive versus a procedural review of the UDRP. The first one is more difficult. The second one is not that it's easier, but it's more straightforward. It is less controversial. It will create, I think, less tensions. But at the same time, we need to remember that in many cases, I personally feel at least, that it is difficult to separate and divorce substance from process. So we might find ourselves in a position that we will start talking about process, and inevitably this will lead to some discussions on substance. I think I should stop now and continue later and pass it on to, I can't remember who is the second panelist, and I will come back with more concrete proposals as to how I believe we can make the UDRP better. Thanks.
Thanks, Konstantinos. And we do intend to keep this fairly free-flowing, and so Jonathan and I, as moderators, will exercise the prerogative to pick up on speakers' comments and perhaps ask them questions as they finish, which they can choose to answer at this point or perhaps later on in the panel. So I think, Konstantinos, the obvious question here, given particularly the webinar and the feedback in that's incorporated in the issue report, is in terms of making the UDRP more fair, I mean, what are some of the specific suggestions that perhaps we can consider for the final issue report?
Okay. Well, on the substantive front, I have always advocated, and I think that it's very important that we incorporate explicit fair use provisions or safe harbors as they're known. There are two reasons for that. First of all, as it was stated by very correctly by the panelists, the UDRP has been used as a model by various CCTLDs for their own dispute resolution mechanisms. Now, this is a very interesting case study, actually, because many of those CCTLDs, in many of those cases, these policies over the passage of time have been amended to incorporate explicit fair use provisions. For example, the nominate system for the .UK. So I really feel that the UDRP in the past 10 years did not really evolve organically, and if you compare it in the beginning, everybody was very excited, and this was a very novel system, a great system, efficient, cheap, fast. That was used, but suddenly, whereas other policies managed to just be more flexible enough and say, okay, we saw the phenomenon of gripe sites, let's address it within our own CCTLD policies, the UDRP has failed to do that. That is the first substantive issue. The second one is a statute of limitations. Again, other CCTLD's policies, like the one for .cn, has actually adopted a statute of limitations, and I think that it's a very reasonable thing to do. The idea that a trademark owner is able to initiate a dispute against a domain name, even though the domain name might have been registered for 5 or 10 years, is quite concerning, to say the least. So maybe this is something that we could think about and we could start discussing as to the domain name, a domain name holder that has spent substantial capital, that has spent a lot of time in trying to build up his business portfolio through the domain name, and suddenly he or she has to face a UDRP dispute after 5 years of doing so. On the procedural aspects, first of all, I think that the UDRP needs an internal appeals process. It is important that the losing party, being the trademark owner or the domain name holder, would have the ability to go within the system, the same system that has created, that has deliberated on the decision, and seek relief. And the huge advantage, if you want, of the internal appeals process is that it also provides for an indirect review of the decisions. The UDRP has good decisions, but the UDRP has also bad decisions. And some of those bad decisions are actually pretty bad decisions. And we don't do anything. The panels that are adjudicating those disputes are not going through a review process. And internal appeals would actually provide this ability. The second one is that we need to address... I need to stop. Okay, I will need to stop. Sorry.
Sorry, that was my fault, but that was certainly a good laundry list for us to consider.
Okay, so thank you very much, Constantinos. We wanted to start out with someone who was passionate and who thought out carefully his position, and that's what you've heard, which is good. Now, somebody who has an opinion which may be somewhat different, and I'd like, before I turn it over to WIPO, who I know will address matters as they like, I would ask them to answer a question for me that arises out of Constantinos, and that is, while I certainly understand the free speech limitation, one of the challenges in an international organization is when you come to something like free speech, there are differences of definition of what that means, the permissible limits of free speech from country to country, and I'd like to at least have that looked at. So, without further ado, David Turner Roach from the World Intellectual Property Organization.
Thanks very much, Jonathan. David Roach Turner, WIPO. Thank you also, of course, to Mary and to Margie for coordinating this process so far and shepherding us all through it with such success to date. Probably no surprise to mention here that the WIPO Centre fully supports the wisdom of the ICANN staff recommendation that there be no PDP initiated on the UDRP. We believe that now is certainly not the time to do that. For one of the reasons, I think, critically, that Constantinos just mentioned in his presentation, which is the still unresolved and untested issue of the URS, which we still don't know yet if it will work. We all hope it will, of course, but we don't know yet. And there will, of course, be many, many aspects, some of them substantive and some of them procedural, in that mechanism that bear similarities to the laundry list of issues that we currently see in the ICANN staff report. And the discussion that we are currently having about the UDRP can only benefit greatly from the information that will inevitably flow from the review of the URS that is scheduled a year after it comes into operation. And certainly we believe that the current discussion and the community's information about the merits of the present proposal can only be enriched by waiting until a more propitious time to have the conversation that we're now having. For that reason, of course, I think we are also at WIPO fairly sceptical about the merits of having a broader process that is going to be exploring a very lengthy list of issues that would be comparable to those that are included in the staff report. This is obviously a very voluminous and complex and likely to prove contentious list of proposals. It's obviously going to be a time-consuming and challenging discussion to be had, and we think that it's one that would probably be better had, if it would need to be had at all, you know, a year and a half, 2 years from now perhaps. We think that the reasons for that are only strengthened by, for example, the recent board statements to the GAC, for example, that trademark owners, for one, would be expecting to rely on the, you know, proven and long-standing and presumably unchanged UDRP for the purpose of the recently announced new GTLD launch. We do believe that if there would be a PDP initiated as a result of the present discussions, that would probably also trigger some a need to consider some fairly fundamental questions about the practice of cyber squatting itself. The instrument is, of course, there principally to protect trademark owners, although it has been overall a tremendous success, we believe, and has been of great benefit also to other stakeholders within the community, not least, you know, the registries and the registrars and registrants, of course, themselves, because it's kept such a vast number of disputes out of the courts, and of the very small number of UDRP disputes that have found their way into the courts, only a very small minority of those have been successfully challenged. So in conclusion, I think that we believe quite strongly as a non-profit provider, that having administered somewhat over 20,000 UDRP cases now, that the UDRP is in pretty good shape overall. While any instrument can be improved, any legal instrument, we think that now is probably not the best time to be having an extended discussion about process with regard to its amendment. And if there would be, without in any way endorsing it, if there would be a process to be considered, that any changes in that process would need to be of a highly surgical and targeted nature. And I think it's probably also worth mentioning that the last time the UDRP was reviewed, which was, of course, back in 2003, there were a number of points, I think, that were made that were salient to the present discussion. I won't list them all now, but I would simply refer you to them and quote selectively from one of them, perhaps, which is that there are only some issues that are within ICANN's mission, that while areas for improvement may be possible, there does not need to be an urgent need for revision, that the GNSA Council has other issues that may warrant a higher priority, and that, of course, the UDRP is a consensus policy and should only be reviewed by consensus. These were the observations made back in 2003, and probably I think they would be as salient today as they were then. And I think I would add to them as well that it's probably important that in considering these issues that we be mindful that if there would be proposals whether procedural or substantive here under consideration, that the assessment of the likelihood of there being consensus if a process would move forward would be an important part of that assessment process. Thanks very much.
Thanks, David. So just to follow up on your comments, clearly the feeling there is that this is not the time to review the UDRP. If it is to be reviewed at all, that it should be after the launch of the new GTLD programs, and you had suggested at least 18 months from now. The question that I would have for you is, given that there is a list of issues that have been identified by our various panelists in the community that's in the issue, the preliminary issue report, whether WIPO has any comment about any of those recommendations, such as the ones in Annex 2.
Yeah, thanks, Mary. That's a very good question, I think. And certainly, I mean, these are issues on which we would and do have some fairly extensive comments. I'd be happy to get into any of them on a line item basis if you think that would be helpful. I suppose I would just pull out a couple of the issues to illustrate the point that, firstly, I think we need to be conscious that although these are all proposals that have been put forward by individual participants in this discussion or more than one in some instance, there are also issues that for the most part are either addressed under existing instruments, whether consensus policies or through, for example, jurisprudence that has come out of the existing policy. One example of that is provided in the, for example, WIPO Overview 2.0. I don't know how many of you here today are familiar with that document, but certainly a substantial proportion of the issues dealt with in the list at the moment are and have been addressed by panellists through numerous decisions that are distilled in that document. And I think the UDRP is itself obviously very much a living instrument. So we need to be conscious that a lot of these issues that we are seeing here articulated in this list are and have been addressed in fairly practical ways by hundreds of panellists over thousands of decisions. In terms of the issues themselves, I think a couple might stand out just to mention briefly, and I think they also serve to illustrate the point that it can sometimes be illusory to try and draw distinctions that are too neat between substance and process. Obviously, the implications of substance for process and vice versa is one of the first things that you would learn at law school. And I think nothing illustrates that better than the broader discussion about, for example, how to deal with privacy and proxy registration services. I think this is a very difficult and complex issue that has tried the ICANN community now over several years. Obviously, there are procedural aspects to that discussion which exist at the level of the rules and how you would define the relevant respondent, but equally there are quite complicated issues to consider as well about who would be the appropriate against whom the necessary case would need to be made in a substantive sense, and what forms of conduct could be held against those defined individuals. I think another question is raised by the discussion about, for example, the issue of the lock obligation under paragraph 8A of the policy, which prevents registrants from transferring a disputed domain name during a pending UDRP proceeding, and whether or not that could be perhaps clarified to indicate that that such an obligation exists. I think it probably could be clarified. Would it be worth opening up a PDP to have that discussion? Probably not. Would there be policy implications of that consideration process going forward? Probably yes, because the obligation itself stems from the policy and not from the rules, as does the registrar's existing toolkit under paragraph 3 to rectify breaches that occur under that paragraph 8A. So there are some complex questions there.
Thanks very much, David. I'd like to turn now to our third speaker, and he is John Berryhill, who has got a great deal of experience at being Respondents' Counsel. John?
Nothing better than getting up in the morning to a discussion of the UDRP. I'm captivated by Professor Kamaitis's use of the expression "more fair." Prior to the Second World War, the United States had broken certain diplomatic and military codes that were used by the Japanese, and while they could translate a good bit of it, some of it was hard to figure out, and there was a word that kept coming up in Japanese military and diplomatic communications, and this word was used to characterize certain countries or governments or politicians. And from context, the code breakers had figured out that the word must mean trustworthy. It was only after the war that we figured out that actually the phrase meant pro-Japanese. So when you use an expression like more fair, it could be a little bit difficult to decode. Now, I've been involved in about 200 or so UDRP proceedings, been involved in EU disputes, UK disputes, .US disputes, .IN disputes, and both for respondents and for complainants. And I've won a few, and I've lost a few, and nobody wins them all. And when we're looking at, you know, how we want this to be more fair and to whom, it is important to realize that this is a procedure designed for the benefit of intellectual property owners, in which between 85 and 90% of the time, the trademark claimant does prevail. Now, when you're looking at a success rate of between, you know, 85 or 90%, it's difficult to imagine, you know, what more you might want in terms of substantive decision making. Now, Ms. Kawaguchi is going to talk to us about certain practical difficulties that she's had, but, you know, of the cases that I've lost, which are the more interesting ones, I think, to me, most of the time I feel like they've been decided reasonably, and reasonable minds can differ. Panels tend to give, you know, a lot of thought to these decisions, and you know, I think that if a panel finds itself engaging in too much thought, perhaps they have a dispute on their hands that is not structured for, you know, a very quick administrative proceeding. There's a small residue of cases where, I believe they were unfairly decided. You know, and I think everybody knows about that awful UDRP decision. Professor Milton Mueller, who's here this morning, in his paper some years ago, characterized certain decisions as RBDs, or really bad decisions. I don't think that the bad decisions that everyone gets excited about, or at least everyone in the community that I'm involved in gets excited about, are indicative of flaws in the policy. You know, I feel that sometimes panels make errors in applying or interpreting the policy, but that's not a policy problem. Some UDRP panelists are not well-grounded in trademark law. The providers have different criteria for who can become panelists. And giving UDRP panelists more words to work with, I don't think is you know, an opportunity for clarity so much as for further misinterpretation. The substantive nature of the policy, the three criteria, are very open-ended and very flexible, and that's important in an international context. One of the most important rules of the procedure is Rule 15, that a panel may apply any principle of law it deems applicable. So whatever one's favorite legal doctrine or principle may be, it is baked into the policy if you can persuade a panel that the principle that you'd like applied is applicable. And it's very important to have that flexibility in an international context because trademark law is not uniform. It's very easy for us to speak about things like fair use. There's various fair use or nominative use doctrines in U.S. law. In Europe, there's Article 16 of the European Trademark Directive, which encapsulates certain principles of nominative use, spare parts, that kind of thing. But where you've got a dispute between, for example, two parties, if the domain registrant and the trademark claimant are in, say, Latin or South America, it's not appropriate to apply the same principles of fair use in a geographically isolated dispute that you may, you know, where it may essentially amount to an imposition of law that does not apply to either party upon them. In that small residue, again, sometimes panels have decided the decision on grounds that had nothing to do with the arguments made by either party, which is always interesting when that pops out of a surprise. So if we look at Rule 15 as the more interesting rule to bring in any principle of law that a panel deems applicable, there is, I think it's in Rule 12, where a panel may request further information from the parties, and it's probably one of the least used rules whereby a panel can, if they're having a hard time making a decision, draw in additional facts from the parties. But again, these types of patterns one finds in decisions which are, you know, one may consider to be wrongly decided or decided without notice to the parties of the grounds of decision. It's more a matter of how the panelists interpret and apply the existing policy. There has been a large body of decisions, and large also needs to be put into context of, you know, when you're talking about 30,000 decisions over 10 years, and there are currently some 90 million domain names in the GTLDs, 30,000 disputes is a statistically non-existent number. And if one wants to characterize UDRP decisions as being fair or unfair, it would be useful to put that in context of how many out of these 30,000 decisions, what proportion are unfair, because in any process of human decision-making, you know, one is not going to achieve perfection. I will say that among domain registrants, there's a wide perception of unfairness, and partly that's because the bad cases get a lot of attention. And some of the most vocal critics of the process tend to have the least engagement with the process, but they can rattle off those five or six horrific UDRP decisions that are generally tied to some sort of conspiracy theory or assertion that this is an awful thing. What I tend to suggest to that community is that the UDRP provides an opportunity to engage in an alternative dispute resolution process at virtually no cost to the domain registrant, or very low cost compared to conducting litigation in what would be an inconvenient forum. And it can frequently provide a trademark claimant who is just, you know, off on the wrong track with a strong dose of reality that may deter litigation. Neither party is prevented from pursuing litigation. So I think it's important that, you know, one keep that in perspective in terms of the UDRP not being intended to grant additional rights, you know, to either party or rights to parties in various jurisdictions which are not appropriate to the rights that they would otherwise possess under the applicable law. Now, I started by saying that trademark claimants win, you know, 85% of the time, and I think part of the question in the trademark community is, well, yes, I can win 85% of the time, but why should I have to? This is a tremendously expensive thing to say, you know, to spend $1,500 to $2,000 in fees plus attorney time, which is typically more than that, for what amounts to a no-brainer situation. And part of the calculation that you never see on that end is, you know, if a cyber squatter has a domain name that's making $20,000 a year of value to them, and you spend $5,000 on a UDRP to obtain it, that remaining $15,000 in value doesn't, you know, disappear. But maybe we'll get into that. Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you very much, John. Very interesting, as usual. I'm now going to turn the mic over to Mark Partridge, who's representing the American Bar Association.
Thank you,
Jonathan.
John.
I'm sorry, Mark, before you do that, I think what we probably want to tell folks who are here is that we do plan to stop briefly after our fourth panelist, since we've got a panel of eight, because all our three panelists up to now, and definitely Mark, too, will have given us some food for thought on top of the issue report. So we will pause after Mark's presentation to allow the audience to ask questions and to make comments.
All right. Thank you, Mary. Thank you, Jonathan. I'm Mark Partridge, and my role here on this panel is because I'm a panelist with the UDRP process. I was worked with WIPO in the early stages of formulating the policy that was adopted by ICANN. I've been a panelist since the start of the process. I've seen a lot of change in the decision-making that's gone on in the UDRP process. I recognize that there have been decisions that are bad decisions. In the early stages, we were looking at a system that did have a lot of uncertainty, not simply with the UDRP, but with trademark law applied to trademarks generally. We had a completely new law in the United States, the Anti-Cybersquatting Consumer Protection Act, that was before that, there was incredible uncertainty. And one of the points about why do we have the UDRP policy, if you go back into the 90s, you faced a situation where the registry and registrar of the time, Network Solutions, was in court virtually every day dealing with claims that they were facilitating cyber squatting. Registries and registrars, therefore, were at risk as a part of this. And the UDRP brings stability to that in terms of benefiting registries, registrars, registrants, who back in the 90s would face procedures where they really had no relief that would take the claim away from them unless they were prepared to actually go to court. The UDRP was designed to reconcile those various concerns and try to create a cheaper, more efficient dispute resolution policy. It's a balancing of many interests that include registries, registrants, registrars, brand owners, and internet users who, you know, have a right to find the goods and services they're looking for, have a right to find the content and information they're looking for. In terms of deciding, does one want to open this up for reconsideration, I think probably three things to think about. First of all, is it necessary? Secondly, would it be beneficial? And third, is the time right to do it? As far as it being necessary, Konstantinos and I debate these issues quite a bit. We served on the STI together, and I think we have a pretty good understanding of each other's points of views, and oftentimes we're not all that far apart. But Konstantinos made a statement that it's not truly a fair system. Well, that really needs to be explored more deeply. It's an assumption that needs some proof. And is the unfairness in cases that are outliers? Generally, is it a system where good faith registrants are going to prevail and good faith trademark owners are going to prevail, or are there lots of problems? That hasn't been shown, and for the most part, what we're hearing from the people, as John suggests, who are actively engaged in the process, is overall it does work fairly well for resolving disputes, which is what it's intended to do. Now, things have changed a lot in the last 10 years. When the process started out, it existed in a world of uncertainty about the legal issues in this area. There's always uncertainty in the law, but now we have not only 10 years of decision, UDRP decisions behind us, but we have 10 years of court decisions, both in the United States and other places, and panelists look to that. As John mentioned, panelists have a rule that they can apply the appropriate law that's applicable to the case. In the early days, there was less of that to turn to. So the panelists would think, well, what would be the right application of the legal principles to this situation? Now we're guided not just by UDRP decisions, but by the courts. That provides more certainty to the participants. There are more advocates who are experienced with the process, people like John, who represent registrants and complainants, as he said. I also represent parties in UDRP actions. Advocates are more experienced with the process. There's an ability to appeal the process by going to the court, and registrants do that. They can do it on a pro se basis and have. But so I think you really need to test the question of whether it is necessary to open it up for a review and consideration. If you did open it up, would it be beneficial? There are tweaks that people can point to that would benefit certain interests, and John pointed out some of that depends on where your interests lie. Going through the list, you'll see some of those changes would benefit one group or would benefit the other, but overall it's a balance. I think the bigger picture, though, is the stability of the process and how important that is. Right now, it's a fairly stable process. It gives domain name registrants a pretty good idea of what they can and can't do with domain names that they register. And there are always people creative who will push the boundaries. And if they do push the boundaries, well, they might have to justify that. But there's a pretty well-established area where you can know that you're operating within a safe harbor. So given that it creates a good deal of stability for registrants, also it creates stability for registries and registrars. Remember back in the 90s when registry and registrar were being sued over these things in court rather than having this simple process. So think about, would it be beneficial to change that stability? And then the question is the time right to change that stability? We're just launching into a whole new change of the DNS system with the launch of new GTLDs, creating a lot of uncertainty. Is it a good time to be adding more uncertainty to expected practices and norms within the UDRP process, changing expectations about that and creating more instability in the system? So I think those are important things to think about. John mentioned something about that often it seems that cases are for the most part rightly decided, and sometimes not. But it often seems that the mistakes aren't the result of the policy itself, but they're more the result of the policy not being applied. So that brings us to a point where what may be needed is more education, not a change in what exists in the policy. WIPO does do some education in Geneva, Switzerland, about what are the best practices for panelists. But that's hard to get to for a lot of people. John suggested that registrants aren't always well-versed in how they can defend themselves, how they can deal with the process. Again, that's not something where you need to change the process or the policy. That's something where you would have education. What could ICANN do? ICANN could arrange for opportunities for there to be education on how to participate in the process from all around, educate panelists on best practices, educate registrants on best practices and what it really means. And I'll just end with one point. We have to be sure everybody understands what the policy says, what's there. There's been the suggestion here that it doesn't account for fair use. Well, there is a provision within the policy that specifically identifies that fair use can be a safe harbor, is a circumstance. There are not specific examples of what constitutes fair use, but that goes to the flexibility. What people do changes over time. But it's accounted for there, and there are cases that specifically address free speech and lay out the principles of free speech that would apply to this. There are probably many. I'm familiar with a few of them that I worked on. And those and others, through the decision, plus court decisions, recognize the principles of free speech being protected within this process. So I'll end there in the interest of time. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mark. As Mary said, I think what we're going to do is, so that we don't inadvertently run out of time and cut off the ability of people in the audience, either here or online, to ask questions, to take some time now to get questions, if there are any, from the first four speakers. If I can sum up as best I can see it, what I'm hearing is that forgetting the question about whether a review is needed, the speakers seem to suggest that the question is the need for a review sufficiently urgent, useful, or important at this time, that it should take place now, possibly creating uncertainty before the new GTLDs and RPMs have been in operation for 18 months to assess how the UDRP and RPMs are working, so it's not an exercise based only on past experience. Clearly, a couple of speakers think yes, and some are suggesting, in my view, probably not. So enough of that. Let's have questions. And I see Milton, you're at the mic. It's all yours.
Okay. Is this on? Can you hear me? Doesn't sound. Okay, there we go. So I have a comment and then a question, which will probably be directed at John. So the comment is, it seems to me we are doing a review of the UDRP. We're debating and discussing its merits, its fairness, its effectiveness, and so on. And I guess maybe a general question might be, if those of you who are so convinced that the UDRP will stand up to this scrutiny, why would you be afraid of a review? Why wouldn't you want to just go through a process as a matter of routine and say, okay, it survived the scrutiny, nothing's going to change? Do you not have faith in the rationality of the ICAM process? I don't know how anybody could not have that faith. But one point about the process I do want to comment on, I'm really disturbed, Margie, about the staff's opinionated nature of their intervention. It seems to me that the staff is here to facilitate things, to administer, to organize the process, but I don't think of staff as a stakeholder who should be weighing in with opinions about whether a policy is right or not. I'm really surprised by the aggressive way in which the staff has done this. So anyway, those are the comments. The questions for John are very simple. You made the correct point that there is a percentage, maybe 2% of RBDs, really bad decisions. Do you think an appeals process would be a good way to reverse these? Conversely, what is the likelihood that trademark holders or others would abuse the appeals process, dragging things out? And do you agree with Constantinos that there could be a statute of limitations, that would be an improvement on the process?
Yeah, we'll go to Margie and then to John, because that's the order of your questions, Milton.
Sure, Milton. To address your concern, if you take a look at the ICANN bylaws, Annex A, it explores what should be in a preliminary issue report. And so the preliminary issue report addresses two aspects. One, primarily, is it in scope of the GNSO Council? You know, is it appropriate for the GNSO Council to look at this? And, I didn't cover it in our slide, but we certainly do believe it is within scope, and it's perfectly appropriate for the GNSO Council to do that. But the second part of the bylaws asks for staff opinion. And so this is not unusual in this issue report. It's in prior issue reports, including the one that I think was issued back in 2003 on the UDRP, when Dan Halloran, back when he was on staff, wrote it. So this is a normal part of the process. It's something that the council can disregard, and it actually does. With the vertical integration one, for example, we made a similar recommendation not to proceed, and they went ahead and proceeded. And that's fine. I mean, that's the prerogative of the council. But that is the role of staff, and it's in the bylaws to express our opinion.
Milton, I'll take the appeal question first. I don't actually have an opinion on appeals. I don't really know that throwing the dice in the box for another throw is going to be tremendously helpful. What I would suggest that you do, and one of the things that I want to do, is Nominet has an appeal process built into their DRS. I have not looked at the number of Nominet decisions, the number of those that are appealed. Now, I represented a party. We won at the first level, and we won on the appeal level. And it was, an extra nuisance for what I thought was a foregone conclusion. I'd be interested to see the incidence of successful or unsuccessful appeals at nominate. And on my hesitation about substantive review, I will just put that up to personal paranoia. I don't know where this, I don't know why we're here. I don't know where this suggestion that someone was unsatisfied with the UDRP and suggested it would be a good idea that we have the webinar and the preliminary report. And I think if you put any 10 people together and say, what would you change about the UDRP, you'll get a good list of stuff to talk about. But I would suggest that the staff report proceeded from at least the webinar, but I don't know where the initial dissatisfaction came from.
And I see a cue, so this is really quick. And I think the background to this was that this was discussed extensively in the Registration Abuse Policies Working Group, which completed its work last year in 2010. And that was one of the recommendations that achieved unanimous consensus in that working group that was brought forward to the council. If there's anyone else who has questions at this point, I'd ask them to step up to the microphone. If not, we'll probably cut the cue off at Phil. Jeff?
Okay, thank you. Oh, good, this works. All right, so first I want to say, because I've heard a number of people talk about, I'm here representing myself at this point. This is all personal. This is not Newstar. This is not a registry position. So just make that clear. And actually, probably here more of a personal interest, because I'm very interested in being the chair of the PDP work team. I've dealt with too many years of just the words PDP. So I kind of want to ask Margie a question first, because I'm kind of amazed, just like Milton is, at the staff recommendation. Not necessarily for the same reasons, but the interesting statement that I saw in one of the slides, and I don't know if you could pull it back up, but it basically said that the staff was thought that, or the opinion, or the community was of the opinion that a PDP could undermine or affect the stability of the UDRP. It was something like that. And I find that really amazing. How is it that a PDP can undermine the stability of the UDRP? I can understand outcomes of a PDP, recommendations of a PDP, if implemented, could affect the outcome. And that's my message here, is to talk about outcomes. Everybody up here, whether it's Constantinos in favor of having a PDP on the UDRP, or the other speakers that were against having a PDP on the UDRP, are all expressing their opinions because of either a fear of an outcome or in favor of an outcome. And I would suggest to everyone, including ICANN staff, that that is not the way you should look when you're doing a PDP. A PDP is not, you don't judge whether to do a PDP based on what outcomes you want or you don't want. You judge a PDP on its merits as to whether something should be reviewed. And then, because always at the end, there will be recommendations. And those recommendations require consensus in order to be implemented. If people don't like that, if the IP owners, the business constituency, the registries, the registrars, they don't like it, they vote against it, and it doesn't get implemented, right? Then it's not achieved by a consensus. So what I'd like to hear from the rest of the speakers is not they don't want a PDP because they're afraid of the outcome, or they want a PDP because they want a specific outcome. It's what is your fear of doing the PDP? What is it about those three magical letters, PDP, that evokes such emotion? You know, why is it different to say we'll call a panel of experts?
Jeff,
so, yeah, I'll wrap
thank
up.
You.
Thanks. So that's my question.
Since we have quite a lot of people lined up, but we do have Mark who wants to make a brief response.
Just real quick, John. I don't think I'm afraid of the outcome. I'm concerned that by opening it up and having uncertainty about what the outcome will be is unwise. So I don't think everybody up on the panel is up here saying they're afraid of the outcome.
Yeah. All right, I'm not going to ask.
Let me pick the experts, and I'll be perfectly happy with it.
And maybe we can come back to that. I don't know if the other panelists will be addressing this point, but it will be quite interesting. David, do you have a brief comment, and then we'll take a few questions.
Just a quick comment, Mary, thanks. I think one of the aspects worth noting there is that firstly, I think there is an element of uncertainty because nobody knows what a PDP on the UDRP would look like because we haven't had one yet. The second point, I think, is that it is whatever it may mean in ICANN parlance, I mean, it's a policy development process, and presumably it's going to involve a fairly significant investment of resources and time and effort, et cetera, et cetera. And usually you wouldn't think that a process like that would be initiated without some sense of we would like it to go somewhere in terms of the change. And presumably it would be the sort of thing that you would not invest all of those efforts in if there was not some reasonable prospect of a consensus being reached on the issues that it would seek to address. And fourthly, I think that, again, going back to John's point, I think there is an element of uncertainty about where the onus for this particular PDP or the preliminary steps that have preceded it has come from. And it seems that there have been some, a bit like the patient who hasn't been to the doctor for a few years, and you say, well, let's have a look at this and take its pulse and see how it's going. And it seems that we've done that. We've had a webinar, we've looked at the instrument, and the view, at least of the participants in that process, seems to be everything is working pretty well. There are some minor issues, but they're not major. Do we then go forward and initiate a process of exploratory surgery to see if we can find the problems that we haven't found at first instance when we went to the doctor?
Thank you, David.
Okay, David. I think it's. I think we all need to remember: A, we're limited in time.
Right.
B, that there is a possibility of making comments online, and there'll be other opportunities. And I'm terrified of that. Okay.
Yeah.
2 minutes if you can. Thanks.
My name is Lynn Goodendorf. I'm an independent consultant in data privacy and data security. And in listening to you, I feel that that there should be a desire to make this whole process as healthy as possible before the introduction of new GTLDs, and that perhaps there's a sense that the PDP process is too extensive, but it's appeared to me there's a long list of issues that have been identified. I'm not familiar with all of them, but I have seen that people who act in bad faith are exploiting the ability to transfer, and that they are circumventing this process, and they are avoiding the dispute process. And in my mind, that is not helpful to postpone action. So perhaps there's another approach that could be taken to attack the issues list, and I don't know if that is called a PDP or, you know, if you might have some other approach for doing that, but I do think it's a mistake to postpone and not take action.
Okay, Christina.
Christina Rosette, I represent the IPC on the council, but I'm speaking in my independent capacity. I do represent complainants in UDRP proceedings, but I have also represented a respondent in which I asked for a three-person panel. I asked for finding a reverse domain hijacking, and I got it. And in my view, and that was a proceeding that, frankly, was not what the UDRP was intended to resolve, and to me really demonstrated that respondents can have a fair shot at this. But I just want to throw out several things for consideration. I don't want to read responses. I guess my concern about having a statute of limitations is that I think you need to kind of think about what the carry-on from that is. Because a statute of limitations presumes that the trademark owner is aware of the domain name. So then you're getting into a process of how do you automatically notify trademark owners? I mean, then we're back to this whole, frankly, discussion we just got out of with the trademark claims process, because you're in a position where in order to have an effective statute of limitations, you've got to notify the trademark owner at registration that somebody's registered a domain name that includes their mark. And you're not going to be able to go with just contains, or just consists of, you'll have to go with contains. And I just think you end up with a whole cascade, frankly, of headaches that I'm not sure anyone in this room even wants to think about, given some of the heartburn we're all having about this. Second, I am intrigued with the prospect of an appeal. I'm not sure what I would like to find out before we go any further down that road is what universe of people would that actually apply to? Because it would seem to me that if you're going to have an appeal process, you really need to limit it to parties that actually participated. So in other words, I don't think you can fairly say to a respondent, okay, well, you didn't respond, you didn't bother to respond, you didn't ask for an extension. But now that there's a decision, you can seek an appeal. So I would be very curious to find out, for example, from the providers, in what percentage of cases where respondents actually participate, do they actually lose? And I have a feeling that that number is probably a lot lower than we may all think. I do think, based on my respondent representation, educating the trademark and registrant community about what is and is not appropriate for the UDRP, what it is supposed to do, what it's not supposed to do, in my view, I think could take care of some of the problem. But I'll obviously defer to the panelists here. As to just picking up on a point that's been made, I think we really should explore what we can do other than through a PDP. You know, I think we've been making review synonymous with PDP, and I'm not sure that's appropriate. And as to Jeff's point, yeah, absolutely. Those three words give me a headache, the likes of which I generally never have. Because for me, it means a big, gigantic time commitment of years with a process that can sometimes go on a life of its own. Because the ICANN community is so inclusive, you not infrequently have very vocal participants who, frankly, don't really know much about the topic. So just kind of ending there, I would just really encourage us to think, is there a different way to deal with these problems?
Thanks, Christina. And I should just say to Jen, I'm sorry, we were going to cut off the queue at Wendy, but we will have another opportunity for questions a little bit later. I just didn't want you to keep standing there. Thank you very much.
So,
well, I had asked for... I'm sorry, Phil. You are privileged to stand in front of David at the very least. But we had asked for others to come up to the mic when I made the announcement. And let's just go to this side of the mic.
Okay, Zbyněk Leb, an internet lawyer previously associated with ADR.eu and Czech Arbitration Court. I think probably... anybody can see that UDRP has proven as a well-designed dispute resolution system. And there is plenty of evidence for that. And as we know, it has now become an online dispute resolution system. So it is evolving in time, and as it was said, it is very flexible. It is very valuable, and it also seems that it fits the intellectual property rights systems, etc., which must be flexible, as we know. I think that it would be, if there should be a PDP process with a big if, then, in my view, we should wait for some time, because I believe that with the introduction of new GTLDs and with URS, etc., that there will be some further changes in and positive developments, and I really believe that there will be positive developments in improving the activities of the UDRP providers, that there would be probably it may be that there may be new URS providers, that the current UDRP providers may also start to become URS providers, and this would influence their activities to the better. So I think that at that moment I would prefer that I can continue the supervision of quality of the UDRP providers, and at the same time perhaps convene a group of experts. And potentially one of the outcomes of this group of experts may be a call for a UDRP, but I would defer it to a later stage. Thank you.
We'll go to Phil and then Wendy to balance out the mic, and David, you get to close us out for this.
Thank you very much, Mary. I'm Phil Corwin. I'm counsel with the Internet Commerce Association. Speaking on their behalf, our members own or manage about 20 million domains, about one out of every 10 domains currently registered, so we have a significant interest in this topic. I'll be quite brief. The UDRP is pretty good, but there's nothing that can't stand to be improved. And there's nothing that should be forbidden to be looked at after a dozen years of use. I think there's a big issue being ignored here, which is the most important word in UDRP, which is uniform. We are entering a new world of not just proliferating GTLDs, but proliferating UDRP providers. There have been applications not yet acted on in the last 2 years, one from a group in India, one from a group in Jordan. There will be more. The WIPO-NAF duopoly that has existed over the last dozen years is going to continue to erode, and the only way to assure uniformity in the UDRP process is to establish a standard agreement between ICANN and the providers. And that is not only needed to assure uniformity, but it's also just unconscionable that ICANN empowers entities with the power to extinguish, suspend, or transfer valuable, intangible assets that deserve as much consideration as trademarks without any agreement that sets, that both gives them the power and sets limits on the power and sets procedural use for the exercise of that power. So we believe that that, let's not get into a substantive a discussion of changing the substance of the policy, because we all know that's going to immediately bog down and be non-productive. Most of the issues that people are concerned with, administrative and procedural issues, can be addressed in the context of developing a standard agreement. Finally, I want to mention the URS. It's our view that we think, I don't want to say hypocrisy, but we see a great inconsistency of statements by certain IP interests saying you can't consider any substantive change in the URS, yet twice in the last 2 months on the .NET renewal and on relaxing vertical integration for existing GTLDs, we've seen IP interests say that should be accompanied by imposing the URS on .com and .net on the 110 million domains, register them. We believe adding URS, it may be a supplement to UDRP, but it's a major substantive change in the structure. So we would suggest that a good time to discuss adding the URS to the UDRP would be at this meeting, the mid-year meeting of ICANN in 2016. That's 5 years from now, and I'll tell you why. We won't see any new TLDs, GTLDs added to the route until the beginning of 2013. The initial 6 months are going to be sunrise and all of that. We won't see URS even begin to be used until late 2013. We need at least 2 years of experience with it and then a objective study, and then we can have that discussion after that study, which would be 2016.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Okay, so can we... I understand all these positions, but...
My question is, what do you think of that?
Yeah, well, that's what I'd like, is some questions, not a five-minute statement, because they can be made very effectively online or at other forums. This is a chance to question the speakers about things they said, not to make a statement on behalf of a particular view at length. The speakers, are, I think, are doing a good job of that. Wendy?
Wendy Seltzer, GNSO Counselor from the Non-Commercial Users Constituency. I do want to start with a sort of brief procedural framework, because I think it's important that to put this in the context that we're hearing from a group of trademark experts and experts in use and experience with the UDRP. And at the end of the day, it comes back to the GNSO Council to decide what to do with those experiences and whether to initiate a review among the GNSO Council of the performance effectiveness and uniformity of the UDRP. So even if there were complete unanimity on the panel up here, it might still be the case that consensus on the GNSO Council, representing the consensus of the community, would be the UDRP should be reviewed, and the review then might reflect that viewpoint. And so the question that I have goes back to the role of the appeal. And one of the roles of an appeal in a judicial system is to consolidate opinions and to knock out outliers and to help set a body of precedent. At the moment, in the UDRP, it appears we have precedent being created ad hoc by people choosing from among what are effectively unreviewed district court decisions. Is there a way in the current UDRP, or is there a way that you could see, imagine in an appeal system of consolidating better set of precedent.
Thanks, Wendy. David, and then we'll go back to the panel.
Okay. Thanks, Mary. David Taylor, IPC rep to the GNSO, not speaking in that capacity, speaking more as a panelist. Like John and Mark, I'm a panelist for WIPO, but also for .eu and .co.uk, and also appropriately for .my for Malaysia. So a few CCTLDs, although I've never had a .my case to date, so I don't know what that says about me. We also generally act for complainants, but also for respondents, and we've acted for some 50 respondents over time, so quite a bit of experience. And really, I'd got more of an answer rather than a question. It was on the appeals process and looking at Nominet. And the last time I looked at this, which was Valentine's Day of this year, which shows how sad I am if on Valentine's Day I'm looking at appeals processes, but there were only 10 appeals. On Valentine's Day, so that's over the last 18 months out of 551 cases. And also, interestingly enough, so that's about 1.8% appealed. And interestingly as well is Nominet brought in a summary process. And there's been, at that point, there's 325 cases and only one appeal of one of the summary processes. So I thought that was an answer to the question when we're talking about appeals. And then just finally, I'd just say I've got serious misgivings about dabbling with the UDRP at this stage, because it's the only RPM which exists for new GTLDs at present. So I think that's the important point. Thanks.
Thanks, David. Okay, well, we're going to go back to the panels now. And we have about 35 minutes. So I'm going to ask each of the last four panels to try and keep their comments to 5 or 6 minutes, which is roughly the average we've had. And then there will be some time at the end for hopefully questions. So our next speaker is, Staten Hammack from the Registrar's Stakeholder Group. Staten, it's yours.
Thank you, Jonathan. After my co-panelists, the first four co-panelists spoke, and after the engaging comments and questions from the floor, I'm afraid that what I have to say will sound rather mundane, but I will be brief. My name is Staten Hammack. I'm with Network Solutions. I'm also vice chairman of the Registrar Stakeholder Group, and I want to thank you all for inviting the registrars to participate and share our views. And while I cannot claim to that my comments today will represent the views of every registrar, I think it's fair to say that they do reflect the general views of many of the registrars. As you know, the registrars play an important role in the UDRP process. Specifically, we're tasked with securing the domain name during the UDRP proceedings and then effectuating the decision, if that means transferring the domain name to the prevailing registrant. So the comments that the registrars have submitted, which are reflected in the preliminary report, really go to process and procedure, because we feel that there could be much more clarity and explanation with respect to some of the terms that that we're obligated to follow, and how we're supposed to effectuate those obligations. We submitted 9 or 10 challenges as part of this process, and some suggestions. And among those, I'll just highlight three. David mentioned one earlier, and that is registrars are responsible for maintaining the status quo. That is the actual language from the UDRP during the proceedings, maintaining the status quo of the domain name. So what does that mean? Well, that's not really explained, but what we've interpreted that to mean is that we put it on what we typically call legal lock status, which means the registrant account information cannot be changed nor the domain name transferred during the UDRP proceedings. So we've done that, but there's no other clarity around when that maintaining status quo obligation is to kick in and when it should end. So that's just one example of some additional clarity we would like to see in the policy. A second example would be there's no specific time frame or requirement for the prevailing party, the registrant and the, or the gaining registrar, to do what that needs to be done on their end to help us get the domain name transferred to the prevailing party at the end of a decision. So it would be helpful to have more specificity around what the gaining registrar and what the prevailing party, the new registrant, when they need to act and how soon they need to act after a decision is rendered. And a final comment that we made that I'd like to highlight is there's no clarity on what happens if there is a conflict between a UDR, our obligations under the policy, and a decision by a court of competent jurisdiction where that has instructed us to not transfer the domain name. And many of you are aware of that circumstance that arose fairly recently with one of our registrars where the UDRP decision would have them transfer to a prevailing party, but the court in their jurisdiction still had a pending case and they were not permitted to do that, and they found themselves at the risk of being non-compliant. So we would certainly like issues like that addressed. But if I could answer Jeff's question directly, and now I'm speaking only in my personal capacity, about why not have a PDP now, my answer would be, and this is at the risk of offending those of you who are feel strongly that we have to continue, or we'd like a UDRP PDP, I would say, you know, the UDRP is just one of many policies that registrars have to implement, and that the and trying to prioritize those policies that are, you know, currently in process, PDPs that are currently in process, and those that we need to implement, this doesn't rise, in my opinion, to the top, given its relative success. And I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That's cogent. Next, we have Susan Kawaguchi, who's with Facebook and a rights holder. Susan?
Hi. Thanks for sitting and listening through all of this. It's been extremely interesting for me. Actually, I do not advocate for opening this up to a PDP. I do have some concerns about process, and I completely understand Staten's position on the registrar's obligations within this. Actually, you know, I've spent the last 2 years at Facebook, and we've filed just a handful of UDRPs. We don't use the UDRP process that extensively. Prior to that, I was at eBay, and once again, it was sort of a last resort mechanism. So I don't have a tremendous experience with it, but I'm very concerned in two different issues I've had in the last 9 months, one of which was mentioned, in which, in my opinion, the whole process went sideways when it came to the registrar maintaining or securing the domain name and maintaining the status quo. I don't feel like that would means that we should open up the whole process, but I do think that there should be some sort of mechanism or just sitting down and talking and figuring out what does it mean to what is a legal lock and what is that what is the registrar required to do? What can a complainant expect out of that? The case that he referenced was Facebook.com. Facebook.com was held by a registrant and used in a social survey scam. That's my characterization of it, at least, where people were obviously it's you know Facebook except lacking a 10, and a lot of traffic. 250 million was the estimate by our SEO team. 250 million hits a year. So not only was the domain extremely similar to our trademark, a good typo, it was someone was making a lot of money off of it. So after the UDRP decision was rendered, but in that 10-day waiting period, the domain was transferred to a third party that had no, we've never figured out any connection to this domain name in the past, nor to the registrant that we filed the UDRP against. So all of a sudden we have a complicated issue. You know, and it seems to me that securing the domain name at the registrar level and being able to rely on that would prevent a lot of problems for us and the registrar. A notification of a breach by ICANN was eventually implemented, and you know that wasn't good for them nor us. It's been resolved now. Facebook now owns the domain name, and but there was a lot to be learned from the situation. And I would like to know that going forward, we did have some clarity on the maintaining the status quo of a domain registration. And the registrant never responded. We've not heard from him, but we are embroiled in litigation today in Luxembourg concerning the domain name. Now, this is a third party. He's in Panama. The registrant was in Germany. Who knows what the connections. There's been some documents filed in the court case, but there's no decision rendered. And I'm not a litigator, and I'm not an attorney. But I just do not feel that somebody who is completely unrelated to the registrant can go into a court and then and file litigation, which is pretty easy to do, and then bind the registrar to not fulfilling the transfer of a decision in a UDRP. The second one we had was, you know, there was all of a sudden about the time that the WIPO panelist was going to render the decision, the domains were all of a sudden in a pending delete status. That was reversed pretty quickly. It could have been a clerical error, not sure. But once again, there's some ambiguity on securing the domain registration at the registrar. So whatever mechanism that would be, I don't think it's a PDP. Maybe it's just conversations with the registrar community in general, so that we have some, we can expect a standard behavior in the UDRP maintaining the registration. That's it.
Thank you very much. Next, we have Christine Durain, who's with the National Arbitration Forum. Christine?
Thank you. Can you hear me? Okay. This is Christine with the National Arbitration Forum. Thanks to everybody for sticking around this long. At first, after the first four speakers went, I thought, oh, man, I'm at the end. I'm not going to have anything new to say because I pretty much agreed with most of the comments that everybody made. So I actually want to take a different tack and address some of the questions that people had brought up to the mic because I really do echo pretty much everything WIPO said in, you know, a lot of what John Berryhill said, that sort of thing. So we do not believe that a PDP is necessary at this time, necessary being the key word. I think a couple people brought that up as to, you know, maybe at some point you want to look at it and decide how well it's doing, but certainly it's not needed. It's functioning. It's working to date, and it's doing its job. The panelists are addressing these issues flexibly as they come up, and it's just not really needed. And I wanted to just sort of segue that into the thought. A few people came to the mic and suggested that a PDP would be beneficial because it could inform the URS or it could inform the new GTLD rollout. Well, as I think Mark mentioned, the UDRP is the only stable portion, the only sort of known portion of the GTLD rollout. And so, upsetting it during this process would, you know, really upset the only thing that we truly know and we truly have any sort of background on. But secondly, a PDP for the UDRP, if you look at the list, even in Margie's slides, it's unlikely to be completed, I think, as David mentioned, you know, before the GTLD rollout, before the URS is implemented. So a PDP for the UDRP is unlikely to have any effect on the URS or any of the other dispute resolution mechanisms that could arise under the new GTLD process. So I think as far as that sort of concern, that, you know, perhaps you can go into the UDRP or go into the GTLDs with an enhanced UDRP or a better UDRP, I don't think you'd have that outcome by the time the URS would begin. I think, you know, sort of tying in with that and to address Jeff's question directly, what is the fear? And for us, it is the whole thought that the people that put together the URS did not look at the current problems with the UDRP. It took lots of comments from the providers before the URS drafters started implementing some of the process concerns. Still to this date, there are process concerns in the URS that have not been addressed, just simple mere procedural issues. While there have been some updates, we don't know for sure that those are going to be effective. So if we were to start a PDP before the URS had any chance to be used or be reviewed, we're not going to see the effect of some of the changes they did make in the URS, such as not notifying the registrant until the domain is actually locked at the registry, putting an actual requirement in to lock, those sorts of things. So I think for us the fear is that, at least with the timing, I mean, the fear for us isn't opening it, the fear for us is the timing, that we've seen sort of the URS process, and the URS process has been what is currently frightening the National Arbitration Forum into why the PDP for the UDRP could be a debacle. For Christina's question, as far as the prevailing rates for respondents, on the National Arbitration Forum's comments in the preliminary issues report says that respondents prevail 13% of the time overall. Where a respondent has submitted a response, the percentage of respondent success rises to about 19%. In 273 cases, a respondent has prevailed even without responding, which is about 2%. In brief conference with David, he has suggested that his numbers are very similar, and for both of us, our numbers would go up significantly if there's a three-member panel. So that would be the success rate for respondents. And then my one thought with respect to Wendy's question about how an appeals process could standardize sort of decisions across providers. One thing that I just encourage you to remember, and that is across all four providers, actually, there's a reasonable amount of panelist overlap. So it's not the exact same as having four different district courts, if you will, because you're getting a lot of panelist overlap for all four providers. So you should have, you know, I think that in and of itself helps with the consistency between the providers. I've had a couple of people email me and ask, why don't we put out an overview like WIPO does? Well, because we don't really have anything to add. I mean, it's pretty consistent all the way across the board, and why would we go through all that work when our panelists are coming up with essentially the same answers to the same questions, you know, for the most part. And then I wanted to kind of finish up with two quick questions or answers. There's been some talk about how would you define the policy versus the procedure. And the way we've looked at it in our comments is if it would affect the actual UDRP policy itself, that would be a policy issue. If it would affect the UDRP rules, that would be a procedure issue, because presumably the rules are only affecting the procedure of how the process is run. And then just to kind of wrap up, Susan mentioned, you know, maybe different ways to address some issues that would not include a PDP. Well, I happen to know that there at one point was a best practices document going around in the registrars to try to figure out what's the best way to handle UDRPs and that sort of thing. And that document could not be finalized because there was no consensus, as I understand it. I could be wrong on that. But if you cannot even get to a best practices document within one particular constituency, I have no idea how a PDP process opened up to the entire community is going to work out. So that's my final thought on that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Christine. Okay, and our final speaker is from the Czech Arbitration Court, Petr Hostas, please.
Thank you, Jonathan. It's a hard position for me to be the last in the line, because mostly everything was said by my predecessors. But So I would try to be brief. We as the UDRP provider shall concentrate on the procedural issues only. And believe me that there are certain issues, procedural issues in the UDRP, which could be addressed and which could be reviewed. But mostly of them, according to my opinion, are connected to the other parties of the domain name world than the UDRP providers, register complainants and respondents, mainly registrars or whois with the proxies, services, and inconsistencies, and problems, for example, with languages which are not shown in the WHOIS information. So I don't think that it's necessary to change UDRP to solve the problems, the procedural problems, which could be connected to the UDRP at the first sight. It should be noted that the UDRP is the only functioning domain name dispute resolution system related to GTLDs and a lot of CCTLDs. And I'm not sure if it's right time at the start of a huge amount of new GTLDs and completely new system for the dispute resolution, the URS, Uniform Rapid Suspension. We do not know how the new GTLDs will impact on current UDRP and how the URS will be used and if the conditions in URS rules will be finally found right. So maybe that it would be a waste of time to start a PDP regarding UDRP right now, because the PDP would take a lot of time. And finally, we will have some recommendations to improvement of UDRP, but maybe at that time we will have the outcomes from the URS review. And does it mean that should we start again with the PDP of UDRP, because maybe that some outcomes from URS review could impact UDRP or could be used for the UDRP as well. I think that we had only one webinar and this and today's session to discuss the problems of the UDRP and potential issues which could be addressed. I think that it's not enough to start PDP on the basis of these two events only. So I would pledge for a panel of experts to determine and to find the certain list of issues which could be solved. And if they will find that it's necessary to solve these issues on the field of UDRP, then we could start to thinking about PDP. Maybe that Mark was right, and many problems which could be at the first sight connected with the UDRP are based on the wrong application of the policy and not on the policy itself. And I think that this question should be answered before we start PDP and not through the PDP. Thank you.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you very much, Peter. We're going to open it up for questions in a couple of minutes, but Mary and I have agreed that to the extent that the room is available and that panelists are available, if there are questions or within reason comments, then we'll stay as long as you like. I thought maybe I could just try and focus a bit. Anybody who wants to come up, come up. I guess I was a bit surprised. I wasn't expecting the kind of fear comments that came from Milton and Jeff. But, you know, that's obviously sometimes how it affects people. I think it's a truism that clearly any system can be improved, and with time probably does need to be reviewed from one or more points of view as things change. But it seems to me the question that we're looking at and what we're hearing is when and how this takes place is not a fear of the process or the outcome, but seems to be more concerned about whether it's a waste of resources or time right now because a short delay would allow us the opportunity to see how the new rights protection mechanisms in the new GTLD works and not have to repeat the process. Now, I don't know whether I agree or not, and I'm not saying, but that seems to be where we're heading. There are some points of view here that have been expressed clearly that that should be irrelevant and we should just get on with it. So I'd like people to kind of focus a bit on that, if they could, leaving it open, of course, for people to say whatever they like. Okay, let's start here because you had to sit down. I'm sorry before.
My name is Naomasa Maruyama from Japan. I'm working for Japan Network Information Center. That is the former .jp registry, and I have some experience in the .jp DRP. That is why I'm standing here. So I'm not sure I'm answering to your question or not, but anyway, I have to share with you my experience. We are the former .jp registry, but now we have the contract with the incumbent .jp registry about the DRP for the .jp space. And still we have the committee for the JP DRP. And experiences in conversation with the committee chair for several years, I have one experience I want to share with you. That is the... I talked with the several lawyers about the structure of the .jp DRP, and also that is the very similar to the UDRP. And my feeling got from these experiences are that the rather than the intellectual property lawyer, the lawyers working for the alternative dispute resolution, that is the legal dispute resolution outside the court, as you know, better understand the system of UDRP or JPRP rather than the IP lawyers, intellectual lawyers. So that is my feeling. I'm not a lawyer, just a feeling. And with that experience, I once have I tried very challenging thing. That is the I asked the our DRP committee chair. That is the university law professor studying the alternative dispute. He also playing the panelist for the Japan Sports Court. Also, he's studying the WADA code dispute. That is the anti-doping activity, you know, probably, you know. And the challenging is that the asking him to be a tutor of the JPDRP system for the JPDRP panelist, potential panelist, that is the, he's sitting as the tutor and the audiences are the students, our audiences are the JPDRP panelists. It was quite frightening moment for me because the as you know, the IP lawyers are very proud people. But anyway, I was still alive and I was not shot, and the professor also still alive. I think it succeeded. So that is something we tried to improve the JPDRP by having the, such kind of the educational session. And here's the answer for the Jeff Duman. I'm in favor of the not having the PDP for the UDRP in this case, this time. My answer is that there are too much IP lawyers here in ICANN.
Thank you. Elliot.
Mary, can I just follow up on that? That I agree with you completely that the process depends largely upon the dispute providers being Shinrei Dekiru, which I'm told is trustworthy.
You need subtitles for the joke, John.
Shinrai dekiru. That is, you use the Japanese. Dekiru, shinrai dekiru. Trustworthy. Okay, yes.
Thank you, Elliot Noss from Two Cows. And thanks for this opportunity. I'd start by saying that, you know, I've said publicly a couple times, and I believe in writing as well, that the UDRP is, I think, ICANN's second greatest success behind the introduction of competition in the domain name space. And, you know, we see in the data overwhelmingly, you know, that if you just look at a macro level down the list of decisions, you will primarily see that the complainants that are successful are in pretty clear cases of cyber squatting, and that the respondents, who especially with three panel hearings are successful, are overwhelmingly also in the cases of overreaching intellectual property lawyers. And so I think that in the main, the system is working. There are a couple issues that I would like to raise, though, and really, you know, what I'm going to ask at the end is this policy or is this rules? So the thing that you know, when the UDRP was formed, and I was around in the very early days for a lot of those discussions, and you know, saw the dialogue. One of the things that drove a couple of the very early rules were that there were, rightly, very few lawyers or potential panelists who had knowledge of the system. That was something that was decided on in the 1998-1999 timeframe, and was obviously true then. The domain space was about 1/40th the size, and obviously about 1/5th the age that it is now. Today we have a situation where there has been, you know, vastly maturing of the knowledge. And one of the early, let's call it exceptions, in the UDRP rules was a fundamental violation of a core principle of administrative law, which is that people, IP lawyers primarily, could act as both complainants and panelists at the same time. Not on the same hearing, of course, but they would be panelists on a regular basis and also could act for complainants. Now, again, maybe in the early days there was a legitimate reason for that. What you have today, however, is a situation where you have panelists whose websites promote their success as complainants' counsel. And I don't think that there is you know, an administrative law professor in the world who would see that as anything other than a most fundamental violation of the core principle of trust in the system. I want this system to continue to evolve and grow and get better. So would a rule that required that individuals chose to either act for complainants or be panelists require a PDP or a change in the rules? I'd love to hear some opinions on that. I'd love Christine's opinion first, John.
Well, since you asked.
I did.
This is Christine. Well, our just initially speaking off the cuff, the only place that the panel sort of arrangement is discussed is within the UDRP rules. So by you know, just tacking onto my further comment, that would be an amendment to the rules, which, again, just sitting here thinking off the top of my head, would probably not require a PDP.
So that's fantastic, because obviously that's a lot more effective and efficient. So, you know, Christine, Peter, would you consider that rule? And how do I go about advocating for change in rules?
That's a good question.
But you have to answer for me, because, you know, I can help you with a registrar issue and would be happy to.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm serious. I think that really is a good question. I mean, there are, we have, while not advocating a PDP, we have said there are some rules specifically relating to registrars and other things that I think could require some clarification or some changes, possibly, certainly not rising to the level of a PDP. And we also do not know the best way to make that happen. And so I think, I mean, if nothing else comes out of this discussion, maybe it segues into, you know, how do we clarify a few points without...
Well, you know, Christine and Peter, you know, I think you all know that you would, you know, if you were to go down the path that I'm describing, it would be hugely unpopular with your core constituents. I think, you know, I think if we were, you know, outside having a coffee or a beer, you would have to acknowledge that it's administratively appropriate. And I won't make you do that, you know, publicly. You called it interesting. I think it's a huge win for me. But, you know, there need be some mechanism, you know, if really, you know, we have this shared goal of, you know, why do we need heavyweight PDP, which opens up a whole can of worms, you know, I mean, the rules are set by you guys. So, you know, I'm happy to take it offline, too. Could we talk about a way that...
I was going to suggest that, I think this is a really interesting thing that we hadn't really talked about on the panel. It certainly deserves, I think, more discussion and contribution from all the interested parties. I think, I couldn't tell if it was John or Mark on the other side that wanted to make a comment.
I'd like to comment on that, Elliot. I think one of the points you suggested was that the separation of the role of advocate and the role of neutral...
Panelist,
is established in alternative dispute resolution proceedings. That assumption is not correct. There are many, many examples where the systems recognize that that people can effectively play both roles, such as the American Arbitration Association, the Illinois Court. This is a, and I'll give you a copy of my book on alternative dispute resolution that talks about this. But this is an area of study for me, and the issue is not whether somebody's playing both roles. The issue is whether the proceedings are fair and have appropriate proceedings. And you can get. I understand you have a different point of view.
No, it's not me who has a different point of view. I think, you know, the maxim, justice need not be done, justice need be seen to be done, is at the core of administrative law.
Right.
Okay.
The other point I'd make about this is that you benefit from having people who have experience in the process.
Okay.
Making decisions. Okay. One of the recent studies that came out from WIPO cases, for example, pointed out that the panelists who have the most experience are the ones who have decided most often in favor of registrants.
Okay.
They may get picked to be on three-member panels. That's a reason. I happen to be one of those people who fits that category. I'm one of the top 10 in terms of decisions, and I have one of the highest percentages in favor of registrants.
We're always happy to pick you.
I don't think it's, you know, it's...
It's
an interesting discussion, but there's both sides to it.
Can we cut this off only because we're right at the end of our time? I'm going to give Constantinos 1 minute and Margie 1 minute to comment. Then we'll go back to Jeff and Phil. And if there are other questions and we have time, we'll go on ad nauseum.
Just in the interest of full disclosure, though, that when you do get a copy of Mark's book, Mark is a panelist who represents parties in UDRP proceedings, and that can be very intimidating. Mark and I have been opposing counsel in a very hotly contested case, and it does feel inappropriate knowing that, well, the, you know, Mark's going to be citing his own decisions to a college of people who have participated in the decision-making process with him, and it is extremely intimidating.
It's, by the way, it's $19.99 for the book. All right, Constantinos.
Thank you very much. First of all, I would like to clarify something that Mark said. We should not be comparing the UDRP to arbitration, because the UDRP and arbitration are two totally different things. I mean, arbitration is built around very, very basic safeguards that the UDRP doesn't have. And I really think that, Elliot, you hit the nail on the head with what you said, because part of the problem is this untidiness of the UDRP, the fact that you have panelists that have actually acted as complainant counsel and actually they're using their own decisions, and then you have the precedent issue which is being repeated over and over again and actually demonstrates some problem that the UDRP, we cannot control who is adjudicating and who is the counsel for trademark owners. Thank you.
That's a very interesting point and does deserve discussion. I suggest we take it offline and on to the comment thing. And last, Margie.
Yeah, I wanted to address Elliot's point about the kind of like the process, how you get there. In the issue report, we note that that we have updated the rules in the past, for example, the e-filing, and that didn't involve a PDP. So I guess it's really a question of whether the update to the rules are affecting non-contracted parties. I mean, if you're looking at something that's going to impose new obligations on contracted parties like registrars, you may have to go through a PDP. But a lot of the stuff we're talking about is really implementation on the provider side and you know, things related to the panelists. And that's, you know, not necessarily something that has to go through a PDP.
Except, Margie, I agree with that as a construct, except that the e-filing was an administrative efficiency for the operators who were affecting their own rules. Good idea, but still it's them driving it and them affecting it for their benefit appropriately, right? How, you know, how do I, from the floor, take an idea that might be appropriate but unpopular and bring it into the system? That's a fundamentally different question around the rules, and I'd
right.
love to
sure,
again,
sure.
We can take that offline, take it to the comments.
Yeah, sure, and in the preliminary issue report, I don't think we address it in depth, but that is a good thing to address. If we did this expert panel, what's the next step? How does the public participate in it? Is there public comment, et cetera, et cetera? So I'll take that back and try to elaborate on that.
Okay, thanks, everyone.
Okay, Jeff.
Yeah, I think Elliot actually made one of my core points was that there are no contracts with the providers, and so there are no mechanisms within the ICANN community to provide that input. So Christine, when you said, you know, these are issues to deal with the rules, okay, great, but as Elliot said, how do we participate in that? We can't. We never have. And, you know, as Elliot said, the e-filing was more of an administrative to help you all. It wasn't to open your rules. So perhaps maybe one of the suggestions might be to actually have contracts with the UDRP providers and also a type of consensus policy mechanism for the ICANN community to affect those contracts. That might be something to look at. That wasn't my initial point, but I think that's interesting. One of my other points was about the notion of, you know, now we have the URS, and so let's deal with that. Let's wait 18 months or whatever it is and wait to see how that works out. I will note, and there is no registry rep on the panel, probably because, you know, historically, registries haven't been implicated, but let me tell you, in the past year or so, we get more and more either court orders or complaints about registrars not implementing decisions. I get between 15 and 20 court orders or requests to take an action that a registrar has not taken action on. And you could say, yes, well, maybe we can deal that through the compliance function, but I will tell you right now that when a complainant gets an order to transfer a name, they're not going to want to go through the whole ICANN compliance process to get a registrar to, you know, in breach, and then you get 15 days or 30 days to respond to the breach, and then you go months pretty much to get the ICANN compliance. They come to the registry. And I will note, because of all the problems with the not-so-good registrars out there, and of course that's no one in this room, because of that, the IP owners through the IRT and then through the STI and all those processes decided that it is the registries that have to implement the URS because they didn't want to deal with the registrars. So the registries are doing everything in the URS simply because of the fact that they didn't want to go through the registrars. And now there's no review of the UDRP if that's what's being recommended. So now the registries are stuck with that burden. And so I do want to say that that's something that I want looked at because I want to stop getting complaints from complainants about UDRPs not being enforced and court orders forcing me to do it. And so that perspective has not been heard.
Thanks, Jeff. I don't think I have to encourage you or others to make your comments online. I'm sure you will. And I think I finished with what I said at the beginning, and that is, we're not making any decisions. We're just chatting. Phil.
Yes. Thanks again. I thought Christine had an excellent formulation for how to generally decide what's substantive and what's procedural, which is if it changes the policy, substantive if it deals with the rules, procedural and administrative, and I think the type of thing I've been advocating, which is a standard agreement on the procedural administrative side, there is no need to wait for experience with the new RPMs. It's a separate issue. Not only is it unrelated to however the new RPMs turn out, but there is, as I said, a need. I remember looking at the application last year from the group in Amman, Jordan, and looking at the background of their preliminary panelists. Many of them had no prior experience with the UDRP. We're not just going to see new providers, but new panelists, and that's why we need something from ICANN to the providers that empowers them, that sets limits to their authority, and that provides enforcement mechanisms if they exceed their authority, because frankly, my members are concerned that new providers will try to gain market share by encouraging forum shopping by complainants by taking a more favorable approach in certain cases. I think this is good for WIPO too. WIPO clearly, as NAF defers to WIPO on the panelist guide, that is the starting point for consistency and uniformity in providing the UDRP, and a contract could talk to WIPO's not preeminent, but lead role in this whole area. The one other thing I would say is that if anything is done going forward, what's been done so far by experts is great, but the suggestion that anything going forward should be just experts, that's not the ICANN way. We need experts involved. We need experts providing the base knowledge and experience, but it has to be open to the entire community. That's the way we should continue to operate. Thank you.
Thanks, Phil. That was good. okay. Wendy.
Thanks. I think this has been a really interesting discussion. It's been interesting because we've heard of people from all parts of the UDRP using and providing community, giving evidence of places where it works and places where there are problems with the system, unexpected outcomes for registries and registrars, places where panelists and providers find gaps in the rules, places where Facebook has found the system not to work quite as planned. And yet everyone seems, just about everyone seems to rush to follow up, but we shouldn't do a PDP. So maybe we need not a PDP, but something confusingly similar to a PDP, where we would gather the evidence of these sort of gaps and errors that we could all agree there shouldn't be a reason for it to be difficult to get the outcome of a UDRP recognized at the registry and registrar level. And it shouldn't be a complex procedure that makes the registries and registrars cringe because it's not specified clearly enough who's responsible for the implementation of those decisions. We should have a place where members of the community can come and contribute their input on rules changes or clarity of rules or problems with the rules that they've seen in practice. And this evidence gathering might be called a PDP or it might not, but it seems that we've gotten lots of useful information and we should continue that information gathering. And I would like then to see and as a member of council to help gather that information and then take the next steps as the evidence and information suggest. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Wendy. Are there any other comments or questions from the floor? We've gone well over our time. Is there anybody who wants to make a literally 30-second comment on the panel? Okay, so I'm just going to sum up briefly and basically thank the panelists very much for their time, Margie, for the time and effort made to organize this, Mary as well. I encourage all of you to take what you've heard today and where you have feelings about it or thoughts about it, get them out online and be part of the process. I think Phil's remarks were absolutely spot on, that nothing in ICANN gets done or should be done by experts. whether IP or otherwise, without there being a full opportunity to have it vetted by the community at large with all the different opinions. What you're hearing today are separate, different opinions, different ideas, different possibilities, and I hope you'll all continue to not only take an interest but to contribute in the outcome. Thank you very much for your time.